Chapter 5, so if you were here at that time, you might already have your notes. If you don't, we've got a few extras with the blanks filled in from 2 weeks ago because we got about halfway through Proverbs chapter 5. Let me get wired up here. Principles. All right, that's what we're talking about this morning. Wisdom's principles. There are some principles of wisdom. And if you've got your notes from last time, you'll notice that in verse 1 and 2, we talked about the principle of hearing. The principle of hearing, the reception of hearing, and the reward for hearing. Again, sometimes we hear things, but we're not listening. It doesn't do any good to hear things that just go in one ear and out the other. We need to process those things that we hear. It's kind of like food. If it just goes straight through, it doesn't really give you any nutrition. It doesn't do any good. So hearing, there's more to just hearing of the word. So reception and reward. Then we saw second of all, and this is where we are about halfway through, the principle of harlots. Verse 3 down to verse 14, Solomon is warning his young son about the strange woman. And again, that strange woman is any woman outside of your immediate family. All right, your mother's not a strange woman. Your sisters are not strange women. All right, your wife is not a strange woman. The wife is the first one that a man takes outside of his immediate family. The first woman that's invited into that family circle. And Solomon is trying to tell his son, be careful who you invite in that circle. Make sure you invite one person and get that one person in, and then don't mingle with anybody else. And so that's the counsel he's giving him about this strange woman. And again, we've looked at it. Letter A, her ways were analyzed, and we saw they are seductive and they are subtle. Then we saw her ways are to be avoided in verse 17 to 14. How are they to be avoided? Number one, we talked about last week, by cautiousness. All right, and this isn't in our outline, but in verse 7 and 8, he basically says, stay alert and stay away. All right, stay alert. Be aware. Be watchful. Notice the strange woman. Notice the harlot. Notice the characteristics about her that we've read, about her being seductive in verse number 3 to 5 and subtle in verse number 6. So the cautiousness. And then we got to number 2 2 weeks ago, and that is by counting, verse 9 to 14. By counting. In everything we do scripturally, we are to count the cost. Before we go headlong into something, we're to stop and meditate on it, think about it, pray about it. And if a man would do that before he gets taken in by the strange woman, he would have more resistance to it. But it is a reactionary thing. The lips of the strange woman, her mouth is smoother than oil, and her feet go down to the depths of hell, and men are taken in by it. And regardless of a place in life, men are taken in by that strange woman. And so Solomon here is telling his son to count the cost. You know, remember up in verse 6, he said, lest thou shouldest ponder the path of life. Again, if we stop and pause and think and pray about these things, we can count the cost and realize what that moment of pleasure or what that temptation is going to cost us in the long run. And if so many, you know, we hear this is on the news all the time. If so many in higher positions had counted the cost before they ever got sucked in, they never would have done it. And here's what he's talking about in verses 9 to verse 14. First of all, small letter A in counting the cost, you need to count the personal loss. Counting the personal loss. By counting the cost, what do you lose? Well, personally, it says in verse 9, lest thou give thine honor unto others and years unto the cruel. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth, and thy labors be in the house of a stranger. And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed. All right, counting the personal loss. This isn't in the outline. You might want to write these down, but these three verses really give us three different things about that personal loss. The first one in verse 9 is dishonor. It said, lest thou give thine honor unto others. It is a mar on a person's character to have a questionable past. It's a mar on somebody's character and judgment that they were taken in by the strange woman. You've given your honor unto others. If you can't be trusted in that, you've put a mar on your character. Lest thou give honor unto others, and thy years unto the cruel. How many have gotten caught up in those things we read in the tabloids or the news all the time, and then have to spend all this time trying to cover up or bury what they did before? And instead of going on with the things that they're supposed to be doing in life, they're spending all their time spinning their wheels, covering up past actions. And that's what Solomon is telling his son. Don't get sucked into that, because it's going to cause you dishonor down the line. It's like this. Would you trust David around your wife? All right. There's just some things that they've done. Whenever we talk about King David, and David was a man after God's own heart, and David just had so many good things about him, but the one thing that always pops up whenever we think about David is Bathsheba. That one thing has marred his character down through the ages. And did he try to cover that up? Did it bring him dishonor? And did he not waste time when he should have been ruling the kingdom, figuring out how to get Uriah back from the battle and how he's going to manipulate this, and then eventually how put him in the front forefront of the battle and call everybody back? Everything about it brought David dishonor. And had David thought that night on the rooftop, if he could have seen down the line of everything that it was going to cost him, I'm sure he would have had more second thoughts about what he did. So there's a personal loss. It's dishonor. Verse number 10, it's debt. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth. Have you read this? You've seen this going around recently, or it's been now, but apparently Congress has a big fund that is used solely to cover up the illicit affairs of congressmen. It's hush money, basically. And it's there's a whole, I don't know, millions of dollars, I don't know what it is, but a whole lot of money to pay off those people that have accused them because they did something wrong in the past. That's exactly what Solomon's talking about. Lest strangers be filled with thy wealth. So not only is it dishonor, it's debt. And thy labors be in the house of a stranger, to work all that time just to pay off somebody else, to give somebody else your money because you couldn't control yourself. You couldn't do the right thing and avoid the wrong thing. And so Solomon's telling his son, here's what it's going to cost you if you get taken in by those strange women. It's going to cost you dishonor. It's going to cost you debt. And then verse 11, and thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed. Dishonor in verse 9, debt in verse 10, disease in verse 11. Again, this is on our outline here, but that's what it costs, the personal loss. Dishonor, debt, and disease. You know, sexually transmitted diseases are not a thing of the 60s and the 70s. Back in those days, we used to hear about them a lot. You know, the late 60s, the free love, you know, the hippie movement and all that. And into the 70s, that was the result of it, sexually transmitted diseases. And we heard about it all the time. I don't know about you, but I don't read about it. I don't hear about it anymore. And so I went online to see if this is a thing of past. Maybe we've conquered that. Maybe we found a way around it. But when I went and looked at the statistics, I found that the statistics are up in every form of sexually transmitted disease. And yet they're not being publicized. And this is my own lethalism. Here's my own idea on that, is they have been pushing safe sex for so long that they don't want people to realize it isn't working. That the STDs are still rampant, they're still going around, and so they're not talking about it anymore because it contradicts what they think they're doing. Giving sex education to the children, handing out free condoms and things like that. The statistics are still going up, but they're not talking about it anymore. That's just manipulation, and that's the way our society works. Just give the statistics that are in favor of what you want to promote. So the personal loss is dishonor, it's debt, it's disease. And thou mourn at the last when thy flesh and thy body are consumed. Small letter B, not only is there a personal loss, but they need to count the moral loss. Verse number 12 and 13. And say, how have I hated instruction, and my heart despised reproof? And they have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, nor inclined mine ear to them that instructed me. Personal loss is great. All right. The dishonor, the debt, and the disease. But it gets worse than just personal loss. There's a moral loss. Once you have crossed that line morally, you can never go back over. Now, it doesn't mean that you're bound to repeat that immoral act, but it does mean that once you've done it one time, you can't erase it. You can't say it never happened. You carry that the rest of your life and the consequences of that the rest of your life. It's not only a personal loss, it's a moral loss. There's regret. There's remorse. There's a desire, oh, if I could just go back and face that situation all over again, I wouldn't have done that. But you can't do that. You can't rewind the clock. How have I hated instruction and my heart despised reproof and have not obeyed the voice of my teachers? Oh, I wish I had listened. How many times in life have we said that about multitudes of different things? Oh, if I just listened to my mother and my father, if I just listened to the wise counsel when it was given me, if I just listened and avoided these situations, have not obeyed the voice of my teachers nor inclined mine ear to them that instructed me. It is better to learn by listening than it is to learn by experience. Think about that a moment. It's better to learn, especially the negative things, it's better to learn by listening than it is by experience. Learn from the mistakes of someone else. Here's Solomon. You realize who's giving this advice? Saying avoid the strange woman? This is Solomon, the son of David. And Solomon, from personal experience, can say, I saw my father go through it, but I heard about my father going through it, and now I've made some mistakes in my life in these regards. Son, if you would just listen to me. Now, that's not a foolproof way of doing it, telling your son not to do things you did yourself. But Solomon is brokenhearted in telling his son, you've got to count the personal loss, you've got to count the moral loss, then let her see, and most importantly, you've got to count the spiritual loss. Counting the spiritual loss. In verse 14, I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly. The shame. Not being able to enter back into the congregation of the believers for shame in what they have done and the reproach that they have brought. The worst is the spiritual loss. It's not just a private situation. See, when the strange woman takes the man in, they think, okay, well, this is private. It's done behind closed doors and nobody will ever know about it. Now watch the news and see if that's true. Now listen to the reports and find out if nobody ever finds out about it. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it takes years. But it always comes out. And then when it does, I was almost in all evil. The destruction of a testimony, the shame that it brings, is not worth the temporary pleasure that's in sin for a season. It's just not worth it. And we have a hard time learning that lesson for some reason. We have a hard time learning the lesson that the consequences are not worth the momentary pleasure of a single act. And so Solomon warns his son about these harlots counting the cost. All right, that takes us to the back of the page, and that takes us to principle number 3. And principle number 3 is the principle for husbands. The principle for husbands. How appropriate. How appropriate in a book that's just haphazardly thrown together by a bunch of old Jewish men. That's what the skeptics say about it. All right, and yet we find every time we turn its pages and read from one to another that the context is consistent and it's organized. It's a very orderly book. Let all things be done decently and in order. And after Solomon warning his son about the harlots, now he gives him the principle of being a husband. And I love how Proverbs does this. How it moves from one thing to another, gives the counsel, and does it in such a tactful and poetic way. See, the problem in modern education is it's blunt, it's dirty, it's vulgar, it's filthy. You can't sit down with a teacher in a classroom and cover sex education without them being vulgar. And without them being nasty and talking about things that kids at that age don't need to know yet. The innocence of children has been blown apart by our modern society. And then they sit down with television or the internet or whatever it is down there, and that just blows away whatever little they had there. We live in a filthy, vulgar world. The Bible addresses some of these subjects that need to be addressed, but it does it in such a beautiful and a poetic way that it's not offensive. Read the book of Song of Solomon. All the way through it, it's a love story, yet it's not a harlequin novel. Because there's no filthy language and inappropriate scenes or anything like that. And for some reason, modern society gets drawn to that. We want that stuff. We don't want the innocent love stuff. We want the dirt. We want all that. And so Solomon tactfully gives the principle for husbands in verse 15 down to verse 20. Letter A. The desires are recognized. Desires are recognized. God made Adam and Eve. God put them in the garden. God said, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. God has a system for doing that, a way for doing that. And that way is between one man and one woman, a husband and a wife. It's a simple plan. And when you follow that simple plan, a lot of problems get taken care of right off the bat. And yet society does not follow that plan. Children are born out of wedlock. There's illicit relationships going on, and you've got a couple here, and this guy goes over there, and this woman gets pregnant and has a kid while he's married over here. And all these situations and all these messes and all these circumstances happen because we don't follow the biblical principle. And that is simply this. God gave a way for people to reproduce. And here's how he describes it, beginning in verse 15. Now you'll notice at the end of, I put just verse 17, I missed something. It should be verse 15 through 17, there at the end of the verses here on letter A. But in the desires recognized, God says this, drink waters out of thy own cistern. How profound. God has a way to speak about something in such poetic language and yet so clearly. Drink waters out of thine own cisterns and running waters out of thine own well. What is he telling the man? Stick to your own wife. Have relationship with only your own wife. He goes on to say, let thy fountains be dispersed abroad and rivers of waters in the streets. Let them be only thine own and not strangers with thee. The principle of marriage, God recognizes it. And God says that within that bounds, that's where reproduction comes from. And God gave a way for that reproduction. Stop to think scientifically. God could have chosen all different kinds of ways for men and women to reproduce. But he chose a certain way and a certain system and put it within the bounds of marriage. And he says, within that bounds now, enjoy it. Let thy drink waters out of thy own cisterns. You and your wife together, go ahead and enjoy the things that I've given you. And running waters out of thine own wells. He said to Noah, or to Adam, again we said, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. The flood came, Noah gets off the boat. What does he say to Noah? Be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth. That's God's system for Noah and his wife, for Adam and Eve, for couples now, the man and the one man, one woman get together, have a family, raise them, and they enjoy the relationship that they can have between one another. Drink waters out of thine own cistern. All right, fellas, somebody else's wife or an unmarried woman is not your cistern. All right, and that's not like brothers and cistern. All right, that's a cistern, a well, a water. It's not yours. Keep your hands off it. That's how simple it is. Just keep your hands. Recognize it's not mine. I got no business with it. Drink waters out of thine own cistern, running waters out of thine own well. Look at the next verse, verse 16, because this is kind of this is a highly interpretive verse. I guess we could say it. It says, "Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad, and rivers of waters in the streets." Now, that almost seems contradictory to verse 15, if we don't understand it correctly. And New Bible versions simply do this. Let not thy fountains be dispersed abroad. They add a word in there because they don't know how to explain it. And so they add a word that makes it easier to explain. So what does this mean? Drink waters out of thine own cistern, running waters out of thine own well. Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad. Well, that seems contradictory. I believe the fountain, that the cistern and the well is your wife. The fountains and the rivers of waters are your children. All right? Let thy fountains, your children, be dispersed abroad, and rivers of waters in the street. Let them be only thine own and not strangers with thee. Not strangers with thee. All right? Again, we go back to that principle. A man is married to his wife. He should have no children by anybody else. He's got his own fountains. He's got his own rivers. He's not to be sharing that responsibility with somebody else, having to pay for someone else's child that they had out of wedlock. All right? See how practical Proverbs is, written thousands of years ago and talking about situations that are in life right now? So he says, the desires are recognized. Then letter B, the desires are restricted. And that's verse 18 to 20. Men and women, we have that desire for mating with our spouse, and God says that's only natural. That's my command. Replenish the earth. Be fruitful. Multiply. That's his desire. Children are heritage of the Lord. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. All right? So he recognizes that, but then at the same time, he restricts it. Verse 18. Number one, by the laws of marriage. All right, by the laws of marriage. Let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Notice the word wife. All right, so it's restricted. God's restrictions are always for our protection. We've said this so many times in studying the Word of God. Every time we find a thou shalt not, it's not because God is trying to restrict us, it's because He's trying to protect us. When he says, thou shalt not, well, I don't see anything wrong with it. Well, God does, and he's a lot smarter than you are. So he said, don't do that, because he knows the consequences of it. When it comes to this thing of the principle for husbands, he says that their desires are to be restricted. Those desires to be strictly toward let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and the pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times. Her breast, your wife, satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. Again, we see God's plan is for one man and one woman, and that is their relationship, and that is their family. That's God's perfect plan. And when things follow that plan, things work much easier than any other way. So here we've got the laws of marriage. Now, in my years of pastoring, I can't tell you how many times I've had folks say this. Why do I need a piece of paper to show that I'm married? In the Bible, it doesn't say you have to have a ceremony. It doesn't say you've got to stand up before somebody and make vows and all that. And I would strongly disagree. You know where Jesus worked his very first miracle in the Gospel of John? The very first miracle of all the places Jesus could have, I mean, he walked on water, he healed sick. The first miracle he did was turning water to wine where? At a wedding ceremony. Jesus put his stamp of approval on that marriage ceremony just by working a miracle there, a first of all places. And so it is necessary to have that place of commitment, that time of commitment, that public commitment. To make one to another. Because we just don't have this, and I, community wife or what it is, you know, they've been married, been together 26 years, so by common law they're married or something like that. No, it's to be thy wife. I'll tell you this story, and it seems to contradict what I'm saying, but I think it's humorous. I have a pastor friend, and he and I were having a conversation about some things, and he said he had a couple in his church, and I think I picked the number 26. He had a couple in his church that had been there, that had been living together for 26 years, not married. And they were coming to church and they were serving God, but they weren't allowed to serve in any position of service in the church because of that. So he worked with them and eventually they said, okay, we're gonna get married. And he was excited and he did the ceremony and they got married. 6 months later, they divorced and separated and never saw each other again. They could live together for 26 years without any kind of commitment. But once there was a commitment, they couldn't handle the pressure of it. And that seems contradictory to what I'm saying, but I'm saying that's not God's plan. It's not God's way to do it that way. There is to be a commitment one between the other. Let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and plenteous roe. Don't let another woman's attractiveness distract you, men. David's adultery down here was started by Bathsheba's attractiveness. Now, it's not her fault that she was attractive. Now, there's more responsibility put on her than what we read in the story. Because there's something, when God's judgment, there's some things that go on there. But David, if he'd have stopped right then and said, this is not right for me to do, he never would have gotten over here. He should have said, hey, I've got my own wife. I've got my own wives, as a matter of fact. I don't need to be looking at somebody else's. And then all that happened there, from killing Uriah the Hittite, one of his mighty men, and putting him to death and trying to cover it up and all those things. The desires are restricted by the laws of marriage. We do the vows. You promise to cleave one to another till death do you part, so help you God. And that's the wedding vow. Yes, I'm promising myself to her. She says, I'm promising myself to him, and there's to be no one else. No loopholes. No exceptions. That's just the way it goes. And again, that's not a restriction for our punishment, it's a restriction for our protection. So, the desires are restricted by laws of marriage. Then, number two, by the laws of morality. By the laws of morality. Verse number 20. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman? And embrace the bosom of a stranger. When you read the Bible, marriage came before sin. Adam and Eve were brought together in the garden in a perfect environment. And marriage coming before sin is an indication that sin is a negative effect to marriage. And that's what he's talking about in verse number 20. Why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? Again, for a man that's married, any woman outside of his wife is a stranger. So we have the principle of hearing, we have the principle of harlots, we have the principle for husbands, and then lastly, and again it ties in verse 21 and to 23, the principle of horror. H-O-R-R-O-R. The principle, and what is the principle of horror? That's when you violate what God has just established, you're in trouble. When you violate the principles that God has just laid down, the principle for hearing, the principle for harlots, the principle for husbands, when you hear it and violate it, there's horror to come. Negative actions result in negative consequences. A man will reap what he sows. And so in verse 21 to 23, we have that. Letter A, verse 21, God perceives sin. God perceives sin. Verse 21, for the ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord, and he pondereth all his goings. The ways of man are before the Lord. Proverbs 15:1. The eyes of the Lord go to and forth throughout the whole world, beholding the evil and the good. There's nothing God doesn't see. There's no dark place that you can hide that God doesn't know what's going on. There's no closed door somebody can get behind and God doesn't know exactly what's going on. And in the context of everything he's talking about, he's letting his son know, son, you can hide from me, you can hide from family, you can hide from friends, but you can't hide from God. And when you're ever tempted by that woman and you're walking toward her door and that door opens and you think you're going into where no one can see you, don't look left, don't look right, don't look around, look up, because God's watching everything you do. That ought to purge our ways right there. That ought to make us pause before we do anything, not just the context of this, but anything that's done, to realize God sees it. And then letter B. Not only does God perceive sin, but in verse 22 to 23, God punishes sin. We're going to spend, I'm glad we've got 4 minutes left because we need some time on this one. God punishes sin. Notice verse 22 and verse 23. His own iniquities. Now notice that. His own iniquities shall take the wicked himself. And he shall be holden with the cords of his sins. He shall die without instruction, and in the greatness of his folly, he shall go astray. God sees sin, and God punishes sin. Sometimes God's punishment seems delayed. Sometimes God's punishment is swift. But God always punishes sin. That's part of his character. It's part of his requirement. He's a holy and a righteous God. He has to punish sin. Now let me bring you back to David and the story of Bathsheba. I remember one person years ago talking to me about David and just could not get could not comprehend that God could say that David was a man after his own heart because of what he did with Bathsheba. And I'm not going to excuse that by any stretch of the imagination. We know that was a terrible thing, and the consequences of that in Uriah and all that happened, and the loss of the baby that was conceived because of that, again, not shouldn't have happened. All that, and God's judgment upon David. You know, there's just a possibility. Turn to Psalm, if you would, Psalm 38. Let me just give you this as we close this morning. David might have suffered a lot more than we think he did as the consequence of his sin with Bathsheba. Yes, he lost four of his children. Yes, Uriah the Hittite was slain and his relationship with Bathsheba was greatly diminished. His testimony among the people was greatly hindered. But notice, just look at something in the light of what we're talking about, and I'm not going to try to persuade you, but in the light of what we're talking about, I want you to listen to Psalm 38, beginning in verse 3. And listen to what David wrote, and try to put this at a place in David's life. Psalm 38, 3, "There is no soundness in my flesh because of thine anger, neither is there any rest in my bones because of my sin. For mine iniquities are gone over mine head, as a heavy burden they are too heavy for me. My wounds stink and are corrupt because of my foolishness. I am troubled, I am bowed down greatly. I go mourning all the day long. For my loins are filled with a loathsome disease, and there is no soundness in my flesh. I am feeble and sore broken. I have roared by reason of the disquietness of my heart. Lord, all my desire is before thee, and my groaning is not hid from thee." Now I will simply say that many commentators believe that David suffered an STD, as we call it, because of his relationship with Bathsheba. The wording of Psalm 38, verse 3 to 9 surely indicates something David went through that seems very perilous. Now again, many take this text and say that David is just in picturesque language talking about sin as a whole. But one thing that we learn in the Bible is that when you can take the Bible literally, you should take it literally, unless it's clearly not literal. And there's nothing indicating this is not literal, that David at some point, because of his sin, because of his iniquities, suffered something in his body. Suffered something that he was filled with a loathsome disease. Now, I'm not 100% sure that that's related to what we're talking about, but it's a very strong possibility. It's a very strong possibility. God's principle of horror, counting the cost in this area of relationship with a strange woman. All this needs to be proclaimed on the housetops in our modern society. This needs to be taught in every school, in every sex education class, as it were. The dangers of these relationships, instead of just trying to make it safer. Solomon is warning his son on these principles. Father, thank you for your word again. Thank you for its detailed information. And Lord, its practicality in the days we live in, thousands of years after it was written. Father, help us to learn to teach from it in Jesus' name. Amen. Take a break and we'll begin our morning service in just a little bit.